From Nevada to Idaho, West Virginia to Missouri, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, there have been a lot of twists and turns on the road to a new infrastructure bill. For details, we turn to Veronique DeRugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Two Republicans joined congressional Democrats in continuing to push for an investigation into the events of January 6th. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the political impact. The United States Postal Service is plagued by financial deficits and operational inefficiencies. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine take a closer look. And the state of Arizona just passed a budget that lowers key tax rates and makes its economy more competitive. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The one issue Republicans and Democrats have some agreement on is the need to invest more in the nation's infrastructure. But that's where the common ground ends, as they can't even agree on what constitutes infrastructure. Veronique DeRugi is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She is here to walk us through the infrastructure debate. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, before we talk about the parameters of the current deal that has been struck regarding infrastructure, give us a little bit of background on the history of this and what President Biden initially proposed, which was, as I recall, something far flung from what most of us normally think about as infrastructure.
The infrastructure bill that the president proposed was $2.3 trillion. And when you hear the word infrastructure, especially when it comes to government finance, you actually think about bridges and roads and waterways and things like this. But there were just roughly $600 billion for those things, and everything else was basically other stuff. It was like lots of subsidies for big companies for broadband and for railroad freight, all companies, by the way, that are actually extremely profitable. And there were a ton of green initiative, but there was also $400 billion for expanding Medicaid for the state patient who would be treated at home. So it was much, much more than what Americans were thinking about when they think about infrastructure.
Since then, of course, there have been actually bipartisan negotiations that have taken place between the White House, Republicans, and Democrats in Congress. So what has it been whittled down to, at least in its most recent form?
We don't have a ton of details, but it's probably all things considered, probably $1.2 trillion or $1 trillion, and with not much clue about how to pay for it. So a lot of the green initiatives has been shrunk quite significantly. There's a lot of initiatives that were not picked up, that were basically not congruent to infrastructure. I think this was more broadly focused on infrastructure per se. I'm sure there's a lot of pork in there. There always is. But it was just kind of a much smaller green agenda and fewer subsidies, less spending, obviously. But also, let's be clear, the agreement was reached because they just basically agreed with an increase in the corporate income tax, and they agreed to not impose an increase in the gas tax and on electric cars. And once they had agreed to how to not pay for this, then the deal was easier to reach.
Let's talk for a minute or so about how to pay for this. You just outlined all the taxes that are not going to happen. So $1 trillion, that's a lot of money, although they've been throwing $1 trillion bills around down in Washington now for the last year and a half on a fairly regular basis. So how indeed does all this get paid for?
The way President Biden would like to pay for this is with a class warfare type thing, like, you know, taxes on the rich, more taxes on the rich, income taxes, increase of the corporate income tax, and that's what they want to do. The way it should be paid for, honestly, it's to the extent that we think this is something Congress should be doing in the first place, which I don't, is to actually use user fees, especially for transportation. User fees is the best way to go first. It doesn't create the disincentive that the income tax increases create, and hence reduce investment in infrastructure, which income taxes do. And also, they do, to the extent that people think that controlling the demand for driving, the demand for the consumption of infrastructure is a way to address environmental stuff or congestion, for that matter, user fees actually do a much better job at that. So, and I think for infrastructure, for purely infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, user fees are absolutely the best way to go. And not only because of the advantages that I just explained, but it's also because it actually allows a much more transparent system. If the companies, let's say, for instance, employs only union workers and wages are really high and they start offering lavish pensions and things like this, right? There is going to be reflected in how much deficits they have. And then if they have to raise those prices, then consumers may be saying, let me see, what is it we're paying for again? So there's just kind of actually a much better, it's just much more transparency, it's more accountability, it's better all around.
Interesting. You mentioned that this may not be something we ought to be involved in to begin with. So let's take this up to the 10,000 foot level here and look down on it. Is infrastructure really a role for federal government, Veronique, or is this something that maybe should be left mainly to the states?
It's not, only with one exception, with projects that are truly, truly of national infrastructure interest. So, yes. If you're building the highway system, that's like nationwide, yes, that's the role of the federal government. Otherwise, airport, air traffic control, a lot of the infrastructure should be just privatized like they've done in other countries. The other thing is like people forget, who actually don't know, that a vast majority of the ownership of infrastructure ownership is in the hand of the private sector. And they also do the vast majority of the investments and the maintenance. In fact, the president wants to be giving $100 billion for broadband. Well, all the telecom company like Verizon and all these guys already invest $50 billion a year on the grid, on the electric grid. They're already doing all of that stuff. That is private sector area. The second biggest player is the state and local government, and with 35% of the ownership and the over 30% of the ownership, and they do some of the investment. And the state government only owns 5% of infrastructure in America. The problem is like, and it doesn't do as much investments as the private sector by any way, stretch. I mean, by comparison, it's nothing. But what the federal government does is like it's kind of like the tail that wags the dog, which is with all the regulations, the labor mandates and the green mandate, also the permitting mandate, all of that stuff basically is an impediment into the ability of the private sector and the state and local government in some ways to invest more and to doing a better job with infrastructure. And I think this bill is exactly an example of this. It's a ton of mandate. It's a lot of subsidies. It's a lot of basically centralizing functions that should be very firmly in the hands of the private sector.
We have been talking with Veronique Dhourughi, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, which is at George Mason University. Veronique, tell us a bit about Mercatus. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more about Mercatus and to read your research and writings?
Mercatus.org is where basically you guys can go and look at all of our research. I am one of many scholars who do a lot of work on economic issues. That's what we focus on. Originally, Mercatus was really specialized on regulatory studies, and it was really a leader, and it remains a leader because traditionally we've been very invested in studying regulation. We're a nonprofit. We're nonpartisan. We're a university-based research center. We are very free market.
Veronique Dhourughi of the Mercatus Center. As always, Veronique, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson is standing by at the offices of the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C. Scott, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
The U.S. House of Representatives has been in session this past week, and Scott, they just can't seem to let go of the Democrats in the House, of their desire to continue to investigate and keep alive the very tragic events that occurred back on January 6th. Can you fill us in on their latest maneuver?
I think, honestly, even though that the Democrats have unified government with the House, Senate, and White House, they want to continue to beat up on Donald Trump and the Republicans over the events that unfolded on January 6th. And so what we saw this week was Nancy Pelosi continuing to message to the radical left on January 6th and offer legislation that would have created a select committee in Congress to investigate what happened on January 6th. The vote obviously took place, and what we saw this week was only two Republicans voting alongside the Democrats to pass that bill. The two Republicans were Congresswoman Liz Cheney from Wyoming and Representative Adam Kinzinger from Illinois. Obviously, those two have been probably the most vocal out of the 10 representatives that voted for impeachment following the January 6th events. And so Cheney and Kinzinger, I think that they're basically looking at the tea leaves here and deciding, hey, if I go down this election cycle because of my position on January 6th, so be it. I'm going to have all sorts of defense contractors and lobbying opportunities, boards to sit on, especially in the case of Liz Cheney. Adam Kinzinger, he faces a little bit of a different dilemma in what happens in Illinois with redistricting. That's still a really big question mark, whether or not they give him a district to run in or if he has to run in a primary against a Republican.
Taking a look then at these various representatives who voted for impeachment in the wake of January 6th, Scott, can you talk a little bit about the political climate, particularly in Wyoming, where, as you've mentioned, Liz Cheney has been way out front on this? Wyoming is basically a conservative state. It went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Is it likely that she is going to face significant opposition in her efforts to be reelected next year?
Yeah, absolutely. And she already is. She's got a solid number of folks that are challenging her and also others that are considering a challenge. People in Wyoming are not going to forget that she said what Trump did was, quote, the greatest betrayal of a U.S. president ever. And so even though Liz Cheney sort of has higher name ID and probably stronger sense of loyalists than other representatives, she's certainly feeling the heat there, and that's going to be a really competitive race and one that Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action intends to engage in. Obviously, Liz Cheney also has a very poor record when it comes to economic freedom, so the political winds are on our side to hopefully defeat her in the primary. When you look at some of these other representatives, there's guys that are facing primary challenges. Tom Rice in South Carolina's 7th Congressional District has four or five credible candidates that are already primarying him. Congressman Dan Newhouse from Washington's 4th Congressional District has several challengers. We mentioned Kinzinger earlier. I think that's a big question about redistricting. And then Catalina Lauf is also directly challenging him right now in the 16th District. So we'll see exactly how the lines shake out there. I've mentioned previously to the show that Congressman Anthony Gonzalez in Ohio's 16th Congressional District is being challenged by Max Miller, who was a former senior staffer on the Trump campaign and in the Trump administration doing the advance work for his operation. And Club for Growth PAC has endorsed Max. And we actually had President Trump return to Florida last week and do a rally in Ohio.
Let's talk a little bit more about President Trump and his somewhat reemergence, at least as far as these rallies are concerned. Scott, do we expect the former president to be a major factor in these races next year? Particularly, he seems to be engaged against people like Liz Cheney, who have been outspoken against him over the last few months.
Yeah, I think he's got an axe to grind. I'm not speaking for the president, but looking at his public comments, he's said that he's going to go and campaign against Liz Cheney in Wyoming. He's going to go to Alaska and campaign against Lisa Murkowski. He's already made a recent endorsement of Kelly Chewbacca, somebody that we have not endorsed yet at the Club for Growth PAC, but we're evaluating the candidates that are running against Murkowski still. Trump is obviously already campaigning in Ohio. where Anthony Gonzalez was one of the representatives to vote for impeachment. So he is, I wouldn't say being vindictive, but he's certainly making a list and checking it twice on who didn't side with him when the stuff hit the fan, if I can use that figure of speech. So I think that Trump is clearly still the leader of the Republican Party. The way that the data comes in from a lot of the polling that we've done over here at the Club for Growth and Club for Growth PAC certainly shows that he's incredibly popular with Republican primary voters, and probably even more popular with them than he was in October. So how Trump decides to weigh in and use that political muscle that he still has in his operation is something that I think everybody's watching closely. And we're also seeing a ton of members cycle through, whether it was earlier this spring in Mar-a-Lago or now up in Bedminster. Trump even said on a radio show last week that Herschel Walker was going to be a candidate in Georgia, and Herschel Walker hasn't made an official announcement there yet. So he's even getting ahead of some of the folks that he plans to support. And I think that's what's so interesting about the political dynamic of the 2022 cycle, how President Trump decides to weigh in on these big, big races.
Scott Parkinson is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, as we typically do, let's end with a few words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members throughout the country from all walks of life. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, we'd encourage you to look us up at clubforgrowth.org and also follow us on Twitter at clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
The United States Postal Service had its share of problems, and that was even before the COVID pandemic hit. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine explore.
It said that neither rain nor sleet nor snow will stop the U.S. Postal Service from delivering the mail. I don't know. It's supposed to rhyme, or it does rhyme. But last year's pandemic, on top of some longstanding political issues at the post office, have created all sorts of new headaches, or really just made worse existing headaches for the Postal Service in a way that probably demands that we rethink exactly how mail gets around the country. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is my colleague at Reason Magazine, Christian Britschke. He's an associate editor at Reason, and he's the author of the cover story in the latest edition of the magazine. You might be able to find that on your coffee table or in your mailbox maybe right now. Post-apocalypse is the name of the piece. You get it. It's a play on words. He joins us now on the phone to talk about it. Christian, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
This is a great piece, again, cover story in the latest edition of Reason, in which you sort of take a deep dive into the many, many issues facing the Postal Service. We don't have time to go through all of them here today, but kind of the big picture here is just some fundamental problems with the basic business model that the Postal Service operates with that just haven't really, like, it hasn't kept up with the times.
That's right. So for the longest time, the post office made most of its money by shipping flat mail, first-class mail, you know, so letters, but also, I guess, what might be sort of like called junk mail, but advertising mail. And as a result, the post office entire logistical network was set up to handle this kind of mail, from its sorting machines to its trucks to, you know, the location and design of its facilities. And then this has caused a problem as people are sending less and less of that kind of mail and more and more of large, bulky packages that you order off Amazon, which presents a couple problems for the post office. A, their logistics network isn't optimized for that. It's lower margin for the post office. And additionally, there's some fierce private competition, all of which has put the post office in a real bind.
Yeah, and so much of this comes down to that the Postal Service has a monopoly over that flat mail that you were talking about, right? But they don't obviously have a monopoly over packages, and that's the kind of fundamental thing here. They can't just shut out the competition.
Right, absolutely. They can't shut out the competition. And additionally, there's a separate question of how much do we actually, to the extent that the post office might want to get more involved in the package space, because that's where the market is going, the question then becomes, well, how much do we want to subsidize government-owned corporations to compete with private entities that are doing the exact same thing? So it presents kind of a political question there as well.
We have to go back to it, and this is something that you mentioned in the piece, just to kind of change gears for a second here, to that brief controversy that happened during the presidential campaign last year, where, I don't know, for about 2 weeks, maybe in September or October, I don't remember exactly when this was, everybody thought that the government was like taking away all the blue letter boxes, all the post office, all of the USPS boxes all over the country, so people couldn't like mail in their ballots or something. Can you just definitively tell us whether any of that was real?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So the removal of post office boxes, this really sprung up in July, I believe. The removal of post office boxes wasn't an actual thing. It's been an ongoing thing, right? Because you have declining mail volumes, post office has been trying to respond by shutting down sorting machines, getting rid of, you know, the blue mailboxes that you see on the street. But what happened is this ran smack dab into an election that was going to be basically all vote by mail, or at least in large parts of the country. And some kind of misinformation on Twitter, I guess, spread that this was being done by Trump and his stooge, Postmaster DeJoy, Louis DeJoy, to sabotage the election. And it wasn't helped by the fact that Trump, in his word salad kind of way during a press conference, said that he was opposed to more post office funding because it might make vote by mail easier. So Trump didn't help himself, but the actual changes being made were not obviously geared towards stealing the election from anybody, but rather a long-running part of the post office trying to wind down some of its first-class mail network.
If that doesn't sum up the Trump era in general, like the president poorly communicated something and then people took it out of context and made it worse on Twitter. And that, I mean, that's the last 4 years, right, that we were living through. We're talking with Christian Britschke at Reason Magazine. He's the author of a piece that is the cover story in the latest edition of the magazine. Christian, just about a minute or so left here, but we're libertarians, so we have to finish by talking about this. It's an idea that gets kicked around every so often, never really goes anywhere, but maybe it should. Should we privatize the post office in whole or in part, and like what's the challenges to doing that?
The challenge to doing that, I mean, I would be in favor of privatizing the post office, sure, completely. The challenge is that you do, the post office currently has what's called a universal service requirement. It has to bring mail to every address in the country, right? There would be some people who would probably be cut off from delivery service because it wouldn't be profitable to deliver to them if you had a completely privatized market with no universal service requirement. And maybe us as libertarians would say, hey, that's you accept by living out in the middle of nowhere. There is also maybe a slightly more difficult problem because of that universal service requirement in cities where it's profitable to serve but hard to deliver. You have FedEx, UPS often giving, you know, last mile deliveries to the post office to then deliver in cities. And so you probably see some cost increases for urban deliveries if you completely privatize the post office. But the real problem is that there's just not the political will to do this. Despite everything that happened during the pandemic, people love the post office and they love it more now than ever before. So we're kind of stuck with it, and so the question is, how do you make it work a little better?
Yeah, it seems like two things are clear. It seems like full-out privatization isn't super realistic at the moment, but it also seems like the status quo of the post office really not realistic either, not working on a lot of levels. That is unfortunately all the time we have to talk about it today, but you can read more about all of these challenges facing the post office in Christian's piece, again, Post-Apocalypse, the cover story, the latest edition of Reason Magazine. Christian, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And again, that is Christian Britschke, Associate Editor at Reason Magazine. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The state of Arizona is paying down debt and cutting taxes. Will other states follow their lead? Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Across the nation, many state and local governments have record amounts of surplus cash sitting in their coffers, with the economic recovery as well as hundreds of billions in largesse from Washington, D.C. Were those federal bailout dollars really needed? I think it's becoming increasingly clear the answer is no, but that's a topic for another day. With the current surpluses in mind, policymakers in Arizona just approved a historic state budget that pays down state debt and allows hardworking taxpayers across the state to keep more of their hard-earned paychecks. The net tax cut of $1.9 billion reduces personal income tax rates to a flat 2.5% for most Arizona taxpayers and caps the rate paid by high-income earners and small businesses at 4.5%. As a result of this substantial tax relief, Arizona's economy would be poised for long-term growth. As Arizona Senate President Pro Tem Vince Leach, who serves as chairman of the ALEC Tax and Fiscal Policy Task Force, said, with this victory, Arizona will remain one of the best states in America in which to live, raise a family, and start a business. Furthermore, he continued, Arizona tax structure will once again encourage more businesses to set up shop here and grow jobs in the economy for all. Following the narrow passage of Proposition 208 back in November of 2020, Arizona's top marginal personal income tax rate increased from 4.5% to a whopping 8%, a 77% increase for individuals earning at least $250,000 per year. As a result, Arizona had the eighth highest top marginal personal income tax rate in America. This new higher rate far exceeded the top rate imposed by neighbors Nevada, which has a 0% personal income tax, Colorado at 4.55%, Utah at 4.95%, and even New Mexico at 5.9%. At the time, Chad Heinrich, the Arizona State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, said, "We have a crisis of competitiveness in our personal income tax rate in Arizona." That dynamic has thankfully been fixed with the approval of the new budget and the significant tax relief it will bring for all. For more than a decade, our work in Rich States, Poor States at ALEC has revealed that states with lower taxes, especially those that avoid personal income taxes, have seen substantially higher rates of in-migration and economic growth than states with the high income tax rates. Neighboring California, which imposes America's highest top personal income tax rate of 13.3%, provides us all with the perpetual story of what not to do from an economic policy perspective. California has just lost their first congressional seat since statehood in 1850 as a result of thousands fleeing and voting with their feet away from the Golden State in search of economic opportunity in states with lower taxes. Thankfully, Arizona policymakers decided to move in the opposite direction from California. National Review recently featured a piece by Goldwater Institute CEO Victor Riches with the headline, "Governor Ducey's Chance to Make History." And Governor Ducey did just that. As the governor said, "Every Arizonan, no matter how much they make, wins in this legislation. They get to keep more of the money that they earn under this tax plan. It will protect small businesses from a devastating 77% tax increase, and it ensures working families and all Arizona taxpayers get to spend their money how they choose." This tax relief restores Arizona's long-term position as a pro-growth state that is well-positioned for economic growth in the years ahead. With this new substantial tax relief in place, the ALEC Rich States, Poor States Adjust Policies tool moves Arizona to third best economic outlook overall across America. As states across America consider how to prioritize hardworking taxpayers with their newfound budget surpluses, the new taxpayer-centered reforms in Arizona could serve as a useful case study for all. For more information on how your state's economic outlook ranks, please visit richstatespoorstates.org. I'm Jonathan Williams for American Radio Journal. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHLOAM, WKDD-FM, and WROK-FM, all in North Canton, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.